ואני לא יודע מה רוצה, מה לא רוצה. אני יודע רק, כך נדמה לי, מה רצו לעם.
אני חוזר ואומר, הבחירות שייכות לעבר. ואני מציע לכל חבריי בכל המפלגות שנחתום יחד על פנייה אל כל הציבור, ללא הבדל עדה.
דרכיה דרכי נועם וכל דיבותיה שלום.
אני קודם כל יהודי, זה הדבר הראשון. אחר כך ישראלי, אחר כך שייך חברת בני אנוש, אבל בראש ובראשונה יהודי.
דוקטור יואב הלר וחברים מכניסים אורחים. הפודקאסט של הריבון הרביעי.
Okay, so I've got the green light. So once again, good evening and welcome to the Zoom / podcast of the fourth quarter. Why Zoom / podcast? Because we planned a Zoom, but many people who could not join us in midday in the States asked for us to record it. And then we said, why don't we do it more professionally so you can actually then watch it and maybe send it to your communities. So what are we going to do this evening? First of all, thank you for joining in a very short notice. We thought that as the fourth quarter movement with what is going on in Israel, it would be worth us spending time with you, supporters of the fourth quarter in Europe and in the States, to talk about what is actually going on in Israel in light of the hostages deal. Now, when I say what is going on in Israel, actually, we're going to try to attempt to analyze what is the sentiment of the Israeli society. What was it before the deal? What is it after the deal? And actually, we can't talk about after the deal because we're in very, 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 very emotional and heated days. In many ways, we'll talk about it. These days will determine the future of Israeli society beyond the issues of security. And of course, us all praying that all the hostages will be home as soon as possible. So in order not to do this unprofessionally, because I'm an amateur in these things, we decided that if we do a podcast, then we will ask a professional to lead us. So I want to say good evening or good day in the States to Melissa Weiss. Melissa is the executive editor of the Jewish Insider. How are you, Melissa?
I'm good, Yoav. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And actually, from here on, we are all in the safe hands of Melissa that will actually lead the conversation. And as I said, this is an attempt to analyze, but not only to analyze, to offer the way that we think in the fourth quarter that the Israeli society should approach these very, very, very emotional and heated days in Israeli society.
All right. We'll flip the tables a little bit. All right. So lead us into this. How did we get to where we were on Sunday, which was the implementation of the ceasefire and hostage release deal, where we saw the first three hostages come home? How did we get there?
So I think we should think of Israeli society and what was the situation regarding the war and the hostages before the deal, before we knew that there was going to be a deal. So you had, let's say, if we talk about right-left, you had one camp that if you would ask him in Israeli society, but that also the decision makers, for 5-6 months, you would ask, what is our policy in Gaza? You would get one answer. We're waiting for President Trump, even before he was elected, and he will allow much more military pressure that will lead to the defeat of Hamas and also to the release, hopefully, of the hostages. That was one sentiment. The other sentiment was, in many ways, despair. This government will never go to a deal. Not sure if there's a deal even if Hamas wants to go to a deal. And there was criticism. The war will never end and so on and so on and so on. And suddenly, there's a deal. And you would think of what happened. The coins flipped because, on the one hand, you see a crisis in many in the Israeli right that hope for Trump. Actually didn't listen to Trump because Trump said a few times, I want to end this war. He was very explicit on it.
He wanted to end all of the wars.
All of the wars. So he was very explicit. And suddenly, at least the sentiment in Israel right now, is whether you're for or against the deal, it was not the deal that we signed. It was actually a deal that was imposed by President Trump. Actually, our prime minister, in many ways, is not backing away from that narrative. He, in many ways, you could hear that when he wants to be fully, fully behind a decision, he's fully behind a decision. Here, he's behind the decision. But keep the press is talking more and more about the special convoy, Witkoff, and the conversation on Shabbat morning.
Yes.
That was in many ways imposed. So that's some people on the right. Everybody in Israel, I think, is very, very, very happy with the release of the hostages, but is also very worried regarding the deal itself.
Which is understandable. But let's break that down a little bit more. How did Israeli society perceive it? Let's start with how the Israeli right kind of is looking at this deal.
Okay, so first of all, the interesting thing, the Israeli right is split right now. When you see polls, you see, for example, Likud supporters, Netanyahu supporters, are for the deal. In the religious Zionist, in the far right, in religious Zionist, Ben-Gvir supporters, Smotrich supporters are really opposed to the deal. Basically, the right, those who are opposed, let's talk about them, are saying this is a defeat. I disagree with them, but this is a total defeat of Israel to Hamas, because basically there were two goals for the war. Bring back the hostages, and that Hamas will not control Gaza, not civically and not militarily. And they're saying this is a total failure. We'll talk in a moment about the pictures from Gaza, which actually... you saw that narrative is not delusional when you saw Hamas in Gaza. So in the Israeli right, I think there is something in the heart saying, wow, the hostages are back, but a real, real, real fear. And you could see politically that Netanyahu's promised Smotrich, the leader of the religious Zionist party, that we're going back to war, like after the first part of the deal. That's in the Israeli right. But let's hold to that notion. The promise is, Netanyahu didn't say it, but Smotrich is saying it repeatedly, and we'll see the implication of it. We're going back to war. Okay, on the other hand, in the Israel liberal crowd, and among some Likud supporters, everybody hates that this deal. There's a lot of criticism. How do we get? Did we get to this point that this is the way the deal looks like? But everybody, on the other hand, says that was... we need to bring the hostages home. So that was, and we have the American, I don't know, umbrella. So we had to sign the deal. The worry there is that the second part of the deal will not actually happen.
Now, getting into the psyche of the Israeli left and the Israeli right, what is driving those positions?
This is interesting. Actually, I was asked in Israeli press, do I have any recommendation to the press? And I said, yes, let's learn from the Shalit affair. And back a decade ago, when Gilad Shalit, the Israeli soldier that was kidnapped and was hostage, and released 1,400 terrorists for him. And actually, voices were shut down there. Like, I think... what drives him is very important to talk about, because I think important thing drives him. Nobody's stupid here and nobody's evil here. I think in the Israeli right, there's a feeling that the 7th of October, I think all Israelis, but they're even more, the 7th of October was not another round between us and the Palestinians. The 7th of October uncovered, and actually I agree with that, uncovered that some of the mainstream motivation among the Palestinians is that the Jews won't have a state. If, to say it elegantly, I could say it even worse, that the Jews will not exist. And not necessarily that this is... and we saw what happened there. Meaning that it's either us or Hamas, either the citizens of surrounding Gaza, the Otef Aza, or Hamas. Meaning Hamas cannot prevail, Hamas cannot rule, but even more so, the Palestinians need to see that after... such a destruction, invasion, I would say an attempt for, in my mind, almost for a genocide. If they could continue and kill all Israelis, they would kill all of them. They need to see what is the price for that. and that Hamas does not prevail. That's, I think, this thinking around this. And they're saying, we didn't defeat Hamas. What are you signing a deal for? In the Israeli left, there is no Israeli left, let's say.
Not anymore. There was an Israeli left.
Let's say in the more liberal crowd, the center, center left, center right.
Which is still the Israeli left at this point.
Which is still the Israeli left. By the way, we did a survey. This is not, I'm talking here, data driven. We did a poll in the fourth quarter among all Israelis. How do you define yourself? 3% define themselves left. So there is no, like.
Do you have any data from before October 7th?
No. You know what? We have. I don't have it in my mind right now. It was not way larger. I think it was 9 or 10%. And center left, no, but there, yes, it's shrunk.
And anecdotally, you hear from so many people who are on left or who were on the left who no longer find themselves there. Everyone has shifted.
Yes, in a moment, I'll give you examples even from the pictures that we saw from Gaza. But what is the way of thinking of the supporters of the deal? Is that we have a Jewish value, and the Jewish value is nobody's left behind. Kulanu achim. And Israel will not be able to recover without all the hostages back home. Meaning that is prioritized higher than anything else. I think that is the narrative. I think both narratives should be discussed because none of the narratives, by the way, in the right, I don't think anybody, yes, some are accusing, but I would not accuse people on the right. They don't want the hostages home. It's just, here's a nuance that maybe people abroad need to understand. It's about, do you calculate who will potentially die from the deal because all these terrorists are released and Hamas still prevails? So do you prioritize those who will die in the future or those who we might lose today? I don't think any nation is prepared to such sensitive conversation. So I would respect the conversation, not shut up anyone.
And I mean, it's a very valid concern because when you look at how October 7th happened, it was because Sinwar was released in the Shalit deal.
Absolutely.
And so you have to wonder of these people who are being released over very likely these next 5-6 weeks, what will they go back to doing? And what will the conversation that we're having 10 years or 20 years from now be about?
So actually, I think there are two concerns there. One is the people who are released. If you ask me, I'm concerned about them, very concerned, but I'm more concerned about what's going to be the situation in Gaza when we get to a permanent ceasefire. And I don't think we can live with Hamas on our borders. On the other hand, I'm torn because we need to have, we will not be able to recover without the hostages. And I think that's the dilemma.
We find ourselves in this situation where people are very strongly, you have the right and you have the left. Is there room for a middle voice and a middle lane?
Yes. So I want to describe, I actually think we're the fourth quarter, so what would I answer? No. But I actually think that I want to take our audience now to the pictures when the deal happens. Okay, once it's signed, people are arguing and the deal happens. And then we have a split screen in the TV, but also in our minds. On the one hand, everybody in Israel cries when it sees the three first women coming. But cries, you know, with pride also. This is who we are. We sacrifice for our people. So that's one sentiment. And by the way, it's a very important sentiment. I think it's very important for the future of Israel and who we are. But then you see on the other side of the screen, you see the way they were released. You see thousands of Gazians around them. It's a show that Hamas, I don't know.
Hassan.
Yes. You see Hamas people with weapons, the Nukhbot, and you ask yourself, what have we been doing in the past year and 3-4 months? Once again, it's not rational. We have a lot of gains in that war, and Hamas is in a very bad situation, but still, it's playing with your heart and head. So once again, in order to understand really the Israeli sentiment, and that's where I told you I will refer to the Israeli left, you saw that some people on the far left said, yeah, you see the destruction in Gaza and so on. And people very, very strong in the left says, after we saw the pictures of a release, we don't care. Look, look, look at these people like savages. They're trying to grab them and they're trying. So it was a real pain, even for people that wanted the really, so first of all, that's a picture that you need to hold. And I say to Israel, let's be Israelis, let's be empathetic towards ourselves. Nobody prepared us to deal with these pictures. Now let's talk about, I'm not sure it's a center, but I think I tell Israelis, look, we are writing our own story right now. Don't let Hamas and Gazians were celebrating. People said, what are they celebrating? These are the same people that accused us of genocide. They're celebrating now. I don't remember.
Yeah, we didn't celebrate.
The people that experienced genocide, not in Rwanda, not Jews in the Holocaust, and not Armenians that are celebrating at the end of the war. And you hear the leader of Hamas, Khalil al-Khaya, saying this is a big victory and so on. So we told people, we're going to write our story. Don't let them write for us the story. And what's the middle grounds? The middle grounds, and I'm not talking even from the continuation of the deal that we'll talk in a moment. Middle grounds is, on the one hand, we're very, very proud because nobody left behind. And valuating human life is a priority, always been a priority, has to continue to be a priority. That's on the one hand. And on the other hand, even if we go through all the way with the deal, we cannot go back to the mentality of the 6th of October. Meaning that things will just be okay. Meaning that we could close our eyes when we see enemies that are planning to actually destroy us. And I think, I'm not sure it's the center way, but it's writing this story where understanding that the battle is not over. We need to go through with this agreement, talk about it in a moment. We cherish life. But not anymore. We're not stupid. We understand that we will need to prepare to a situation that will happen again.
You know, it makes me think of something we reported on actually yesterday, which was Israeli President Isaac Herzog is in Davos this week, and he was speaking on stage about the possibility of a two-state solution. And it's something that he's spoken about a number of times over the last 15 months. But something he said yesterday, it really resonated with me and with our readers, which was that when this all happened, you didn't see Israel's neighbors say, this is an atrocious thing that just occurred. You didn't see them condemning what had just happened. You really, I mean, you saw the opposite, right? The afternoon of October 7th, Qatar blamed Israel. And so I wonder if the kind of the awakening that he's had on this, we're realizing that we are in a neighborhood where not only is no one condemning what has just happened, they are celebrating it. How that's factoring into the average Israeli's kind of apprehension toward a deal while still recognizing that a deal is necessary to bring these hostages home.
Very good question, because I think, look, it's not only our neighbors, it's let's talk about the Palestinians. You know, there's a very famous call that one of the terrorists, the Nukhbot, is making to his mother. And two things caught many Israelis there. One is saying, Mom, we're in Kibbutz Miflasim, we're in a settlement. Settlement? This is the 48 borders. What do you mean settlement? Suddenly many Israelis said, okay, this is, they don't want 67. That's one. The second thing is his mom says, kill more, kill more, kill more. So I think there's an awakening regarding the fact that people, or some of the people, do not buy anymore. I don't know what's the solution, but a lot of people are saying, look, rules of the game are going to change. The Palestinian project since 100 years is more about that the Jewish state will not exist than the Palestinians will have a state. And we're going to insist right now, whatever, there are no prizes for this massacre. We're going to insist that... What I mean, this is the war that we need to plan. It's a military war, but it's also an economic war. It's also a consciousness war. That two things we demand. You recognize a Jewish state before we start talking about anything, and you give up the refugee sentiment, the right of return. Because what does it mean, a right of return? We saw on the 7th of October, what does it mean, a right of return? That's what it looks like. So I think there is some sentiment in Israeli society which all is almost consensus regarding this. Mm-hmm. I don't think it played a big role in the deal. And that's interesting. I think people are losing patience. I think that's some of the accuses of the Israeli right. People are losing patience to any macro strategic looking. Our brothers and sisters are dying there. We need them back home. Now, once again, this is very tricky because this is, yeah, some people say we don't need to be emotional. Let's be strategic. But of course we need to be emotional. And of course we need to be strategic. So I think this sentiment of we've waken up, we understand that it's not about Palestinian state or not. I think that's what Herzog is saying. It's just a non-factor. The factor is, what is the decision? Is peace something that you want, or you just don't want us here? But in the context of the deal, and that's the genius, unfortunately, of Sinwar, he understood that the hostages is just a sentiment that the Israeli society will have a hard time to work with. And that's why there's a reasons to worry.
I mean, I think Jewish society's downfall, if you will, has always been that we prioritized humanity above everything else. And that's exactly why you find us in a situation like we are in right now, where you are haggling over the lives of 94 people. When will they get out? Will they get out? What happens at the end when 35 are out? What happens to the rest of them? It's something that no other society would ever have to deal with.
You would know better than me. but I tend to agree. Look, the pictures of people all over Israel, we did like in the fourth quarter, we asked people to picture themselves standing. Where are they watching the release? And you saw, like a man is coming to the moon, in which is going to the moon and now standing for the first time. In which nation it would happen? But I think that's why this is not over. Now we're in a very, very tricky position. That I think that's why I said we were going to write our story, because I think once again, towards the next days, we'll see what happens, but more so the second part of the deal, there are two parallel narratives here that just might not work together. Maybe we'll talk about that. And I deeply worry.
So I guess the real question is, it seems that there's a decent chance of getting through the first stage of the deal, but from there, what are the options?
So I think irresponsible politics, as usual in Israel, is now, and is playing with the sentiment, each one of its base, is actually projecting to the Israeli society as there are only two options. Let's concentrate in them, and it's a big question, what's going to happen with the two narratives? I'll offer a third narrative, which I'm not sure it is, but I would also campaign for that narrative. So one narrative is, from the right, especially the religious Zionist section, and we need to understand, the biggest sacrifice in soldiers was made by the religious Zionist group. They're only 13%, 14% of the population, and around 60% of the soldiers that died in the war were from the religious Zionist section.
But that's part of their argument, right? They're saying our sons and our brothers died for this war.
I think many of them are not saying it, yes. Okay. But even if they're not saying it, I'm saying it. Not that they have special rights, but they're engaged highly and emotionally. And yes, there are families that their sons died in this war. And the argument there that comes from Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, but especially let's talk about Smotrich here because it's interesting, is the prime minister promised me we're going back to war. Okay, which is a tricky notion. Why? Because he's not saying there are conditions in which we're going back to war. Nuh-uh.
We're doing it.
Even today, he went further. After the chief of staff was resigning, he said we were going to replace most of the army leaders with much more offensive. Offensive? Is that the word?
Yeah.
You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
With a tendency to be more aggressive.
Like a little more hardline.
Yes.
Aggressive.
But not necessarily in a bad way, but aggressive in defeating Hamas. And we're going to go back to war. So that's one narrative. Okay. The other narrative is coming from, once again, the other side, oppositions, but opposition not only, and some others, and is saying, at all cost, we need to complete this deal to the final final hostage in Israel. Now, let's unpack or unfold these two opinions, and let's see why it could be very dangerous. Let's unpack them and then see why it's dangerous. One, what do you mean we, in any case, we go back to war? War is a mean. War is not an end. Maybe from day 14 to day 42 or 50, I don't remember, there's negotiations on what's going to be the permanent situation in Gaza and the release of the rest of the hostage. Maybe we'll be satisfied with the negotiation. Maybe the negotiation, as by the way, President Biden and Trump promised, I'm not a fool, I'm not sure it will happen, that Hamas will not be in control. Not civically and not militarily. Why are you pumping up your base and saying, at all costs, we're going back? Why don't you? You do talk about your opinion. It's important. Tell us, why do you think it's important not to give up the option of war in any case, but be a bit more responsible? And on the other side, let's say the deal of the second part is a total collapse of all that we gained in the war, and meaning you can't stand towards and look in the eyes of the citizens of Be'er Sheva or Fakim or Kfar Aza and tell them, you're safe, don't worry. If this deal comes back totally to 6th of October. So it's not an all cost. But on the other hand, please raise up your voice that we need the hostages here. So I show now what I think is irresponsibly being pumped up on both sides. I think both sides do needs to speak up because it needs to be a market up for ideas which are important for the future of Israel, but create some room to maneuver if your base will not receive what you promised. Because this is a, we say in Hebrew, probably in English also, this is a square that you cannot circle. Is that?
You're trying to fit a square into a, or a circle into a square peg.
Why? Because it's very clear. If Netanyahu continues, it does not continue the war, he loses his government. Smotrich and Ben-Gvir were very, very, very clear.
But if he stops the war, or he, if he continues...
That's if he stops the war.
But if he continues...
If he continues the war, you have here, once again, a whole camp, many Israelis, with the level of trust that there is, will say, okay, this is for political reasons. I don't even want to imagine in both cases, because it's not only him losing the government. It's a crowd which is, once again, it's a lot of people who are fighting in the army and so on, who their heart will be broken because they wanted to defeat Hamas. And on the other hand, as I said, these are parallel ways that could actually break apart again and again and again Israeli society. That's why I advocate for a market of opinions. But on the other hand, be more responsible. And by the way, I think the right narrative is, people of Israel, we are going from day 14 to day 50 in clean hands to try to bring all hostages home with the understanding that there will be big sacrifices. On the other hand, we're going to go for the best deal that there is in order to promise the security of Israel, including the fact that Hamas will not be in control. Meaning, you, with these narratives, you'll be able to sail, each one of them will be able better to sail the deal to its base. Because remember one point, Hamas is not, are not our friends. Hamas are liars. Hamas cheated these deals. We don't understand their total aspiration. Some Israelis said they will never release all the hostages because they want some security or insurance. So I really worry about irresponsible politics using the emotions in Israeli society. And on the other hand, I also worry about people shutting people's mouth up, and the market of ideas won't say, look for the best deal and look for all the hostages at home.
I mean, I think that's been the problem since the very beginning, the idea that total victory is completely incompatible with bringing all of the hostages home when Hamas holds those hostages. And I mean, the question is, there will be a day after, whether that is in the next couple of months, well, whether that is 6 months from now or a year from now, there will be a day after, and Israelis will be forced to reckon with someone next door. The U.S. has said, Israel has said it will not be Hamas, but it will be someone next door. And are Israelis prepared for a day after in Gaza? You know, I think – actually, it's funny. I was in the States a couple months ago, and I was in the George W. Bush Memorial Library – or the Presidential Library. And there was a video from one of his staffers talking about September 11th. And it said, after 9/11, every day was September 12th. They were always thinking ahead. They were thinking strategically, how does this never happen again? What do we do to preserve the homeland? And then when I think about what's going on here, we don't ever say it's October 8th. It's still October 7th yes. for an entire country. And so we've never as a society thought about the day after. And so I wonder where that positions us now, 15 months in, where suddenly we're being faced with the idea that there has to be a day after.
I think it's a brilliant question and framing. Think of a shiva, okay? Somebody dies. You're in a shiva, God forbid. You're sitting the shiva and just visited a family that unfortunately their son was killed. And she told me, the mother, I'm so afraid of the end of the shiva. I asked her why. She said, because then I just need to start to make decisions about our lives. How do we live in the family? How do we get along in the family? What is our mission right now as a family? Everything has changed. I think we're in the midst of the trauma. I'm not sure we're even in the shiva. And I think everybody in Israel wants, in some way or another, this trauma or this war to end. Once again, some want later, some, but everybody, even if you want it tomorrow to end, is afraid of what is the day after going to look like. What are the security solutions for Israel going to look like? But as I think our security situation has improved dramatically, not from the 8th of October, from the 6th of October, I think there's another question in the heart of Israelis, which is a big question. What's going to happen here? How are we going to investigate what happened? Who's going to pay the price? How do we get along? There are a lot of broken hearts in Israel. And I think, on the one hand, these emotions, these people all around Israel looking, everybody's now thinking, how do we fix Israel? What do we? So that's the optimistic part. But the scary part is that everybody afraid of the moment that we will actually need to look to one another and said, what just happened here? How do we go forward? Are you to blame? Are you to blame? So I think that's why we're up to a few weeks that are historical in us actually framing the story of Israel to the future.
Now, this is obviously a big week, not just in Israel, but also in the States. There was the inauguration of a new president. It's not so new, but obviously will have a huge impact on how the rest of this war is prosecuted, on how the negotiations go beginning day 14. Where are Israelis on Donald Trump?
Okay, this is a confusing question. Why? Because if you had asked it 2 weeks ago, the answer would be different.
That's why I'm asking it now.
In Channel 14, which celebrated Trump's victory, Channel 14 is our right-wing TV channel, it celebrated Trump's victory in a way that I'm not sure Trump's family celebrated it. I haven't seen such a festival. They've been going hard against him in the past few days. Wow, wild accusations about the anti-Semites that are surrounding him. So everything is confusing. And on the other side, the liberal crowd, which feared Trump and what's going to happen with Trump and so on, he's now literally people. We do salons, literally people. Donald Trump is our savior. Donald Trump is our messiah. So basically, yes, Israelis, and by the way, Israelis understand that this is more a Trump deal than an Israeli government deal. Maybe history will prove it's wrong, but I'm just saying what's the perception right now. So I think everybody's confused. I think the Israeli right is in a big crisis. Mm. You know, it's interesting. When President Biden came to Israel and said, don't, first of all, I want to salute him. It was an historical statement that gave us confidence. As time went by, we understood more and more that he said don't to the Persians and to the Arabs, but he also said don't to the Israelis.
Sure did.
Same thing. And that was an awakening, a little bit of the liberal crowd saying, okay, we don't fully agree with what you think, and maybe you're not fully aligned with the Israeli interest, even if I'm a left wing. Then Trump says that if a deal won't be cut, hell will break in Gaza. The Israeli right said, wow, this is what we were waiting for all the years. And suddenly, they understand that he says hell will break first, like in President Biden's case. First and foremost, he says it to the Arabs. But he also said it to the Israelis. They suddenly understand that hell will break if there won't be a deal also, and you better not be the people who prevent the deal. So I think there is a healthy confusion because this politics of identity is actually hurting the Israeli interest. We need to stop looking at the relationship in America in a partisan way, in an instrumental way. America is not Israel. And the United States of America has its own interest. And they're our biggest allies, and we need to listen to them. We need to actually collaborate. We don't understand the limits of our power. On the other side, in Biden's case and in Trump's case, Israel needs to have its own independent national security policy. After we decide what we want, then we have a conversation with the American administration, and then we see if we can succeed or not. So I hope this is a process that we're going to go through that actually looking at a perspective that is more realistic at the American administrations. So that's, I would say, what's going on with President Trump. And you look at the future. So the right is now saying, well, this is unheard of. They're saying, with all due respect to President Trump, we need to go back to the war, even if he says no. And the left says, I actually depend on Donald Trump. I don't trust Netanyahu. Crazy.
Well, I mean, and that's what's going to be so interesting to watch play out, certainly for people who are watching both what's happening in Washington and here in Israel. Trump said during his inauguration speech, and he said it twice, he wanted to be a peacemaker. And he stressed that. That is what he wants his legacy to be, a peacemaker and a deal maker. And there are, certainly are ways for that to happen. You know, everyone knows that he would love for a normalization deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel. But everyone also knows, and Ron Dermer said this earlier today, that this would have to come with a Palestinian state. Dermer had said Israel is not willing to have that conversation. That is not a conversation right now. And so it's going to be a really interesting 4 years to see how the maneuvering works, first to wind down the war and then for the entire region, because it's not just what's happening in Israel and in Gaza is not happening in a silo. There is chaos across the entire region. It is totally different from how it looked a year ago.
Absolutely. That's why I think there are a lot of opportunities here. And actually, I agree with Dermer. Most of Israeli society will not agree to a Palestinian state. Right now we see it in polls, crazy numbers. Like, there's in the left, most, not all. I think you can maneuver beyond that, saying something that is declarative, not even about Palestinian state. I wouldn't say that. About peace, future peace, and so on. But I think there are three opportunities here. And the Israelis... and the Israelis should look at these opportunities with President Trump. One is, like in the case of the last administration of Trump, to cut down all ties with the notion of Palestinianization that wants to destroy Israel. UNRWA should be cut. Funding of all lines that actually fuel this notion of we need to destroy the state of Israel. Meaning telling the Palestinians, we're here, but you will need to make a different decision. Until then, let's do the best in order to save, first of all, Israeli security. I don't care, most of all, Israeli security. On the other hand, on the ground, we could go to agreements that are almost technical, so life will be better for you Palestinians. On the other hand, I think that if you insist on that, and then you look at the broader picture, the extension of Abraham Accords, maybe also an putting pressure on Iran. Maybe looking at Lebanon with its new president. I don't know what's going on in Syria. Things are happening here. And you know, what did President Trump say in the last time in the Abraham Accords? People forget the 100 initiative. That was almost a Palestinian state. He actually said to the Palestinians, look, a party is going to happen in the Middle East. You always crush the parties in the Middle East. You never wanted to sign a final deal. So I'm telling you two things. One, the party will go on, Abraham Accords. On the other hand, he said $50 billion and the 100 initiative, you could be a part of the party, actually. You want, you're invited, but for the first time, you can't crash the party or you can't kill the party. So I think with that sentiment, I think actually, I call it PTP, path to peace, could actually be achieved on all fronts in the next decade. But just do not give up the fact that before any conversation, you give up the refugee issue, the right of return, and wanting to wanting more that Israel will not exist and Palestinians to exist. So there are big opportunities, huge opportunities, and it also depends on what will happen politically in Israel.
Which we have elections, what, in another year and a half, if not sooner.
Yes.
If not sooner. Now, I guess I want to go back to...
By the way, we could have elections in 4 to 6 months also. It could realistically happen.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's kind of what I'm wondering about, because something that I was thinking about, we're recording this on a Wednesday evening.
Yes.
In 48 hours, we are going to learn the names of the next to be released, and they'll be released on Saturday. And while what we saw on Sunday was joyous, it was a celebratory homecoming, it was everything you wanted it to be, we know that of the 33 who are coming home over the next 6 weeks, not all of them are alive. And so what I wonder is where Israeli public opinion will be when we are not seeing smiling faces like Emily Damari, when we are seeing bodies being brought back. How does that change where Israeli society is on?
I think it's going to highly affect. I'll explain why. First of all, the people who were killed are in the last part of the first deal. I don't know, the prime minister said, I think it's the prime minister, that we predict that 25 of the 33 are alive. I hope more are alive. But think of the psychology of us celebrating them coming. We're towards the end of the first part, and then our hearts are crushed. We had it in 2006 in the hostage replacement with Hezbollah. I'll tell you how it will affect. Once again, emotions will go high, and people will say, we have to save the rest of them on the one hand, because you see what is the effect of the bodies coming. And other will see, people will say, look at the savages, what they did to them. So I think this is going to be, I'm very worried about the time when it will happen and what will be the psychological effects on us. Actually, I don't know why they decided. Okay, you know what? Of course, I know why, because we need to save whoever is alive most quickly.
And we're taking what we can get, what we're being given.
Yes, actually.
Now, I think we're just about out of time, and I do not want to end on a negative note. as we walk away from this conversation, what do you think are the key takeaways for Israeli society at this particular juncture?
I want to tell you a story. It was statements. When the war, the 7th of October, after it erupted, a lot of Israelis said, we need to learn how to talk Arabic, meaning in an aggressive way. I think we need to actually learn to talk Arabic in order to talk to Arabs. But to talk Arabic, Arab skilled people, we need to understand the language of the Middle East, not even Arabic. And others, people said, no, we need to talk Western. Look at what they're saying in the demonstration in the West. And I constantly told people, That's not who we are, and that's not the way that we will prevail. We actually, there are a lot of faults in both languages right now. The aggressive language or the let's just be blind and make peace with it. Let's talk Jewish. We're the Jewish state. And Jewish state, we value value tensions between values. So when, now let's go to the pictures from the last few days. When Emily Damari was released, first of all, you saw her character, and also Romy, and also Doron. But the story is that Romy came to the mother of Emily Damari and said, you know, without your daughter, I would never live. Think of this crazy Israeli situation. They're like in the army together. And they're coming back. And she's saying, without her, I wouldn't leave. Solidarity in the tunnels of Hamas. So I think the biggest takeaways for us is let's talk the Jewish language. And not the Jewish in a, like in a, we're the best in the world. The Jewish language talks. And these are the three takeaways. One is tensions of values. We want the hostages back and we want security. Two, let's have a conversation. Machloket l'shem shamayim. Let's have disagreements in a way that actually is productive. And three, let's understand that we are writing our story. Our story needs to end, I think, first and foremost with the hostages back. But also, our story needs to end that we're in the best security situation that we can get to achieve. And if we can't, we go back to war. But we are now looking at the future. And there are a lot of energy in Israel in building the future. That's the Jewish story. As Rabbi Jonathan Sacks says, we are about building the future. Politics, not of sacrifice or victimhood, but rather politics of hope. And that's what we're trying to bring to the world, also into Israel in the fourth quarter.
I love that. Thank you so much for having me. And
thank you, Melissa. Really, thank you. Like everybody, we decided to do this as a podcast just a few hours ago. And Melissa, like, what? So really, thank you.
Happy to be here.
Enjoy talking to you. And thank you for joining us. If you find this interesting, and if you know of other people who want actually to hear us, then please by tonight, I think. Yes, tonight. Tonight, your time. You'll have already this Zoom podcast to distribute. And in 2 weeks, we have another session where we introduce you to our strategy of the fourth quarter to 2025. How do you rebuild Israel, actually? And how do you create here really, really fundamental grassroots change? So for now, thank you very much. And we'll keep in touch.